That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 2. Linguistic Styles, Devices, and Rituals.
In this lecture, I want to look a little bit more closely at the linguistic elements that make up conversational style. I want to further distinguish among them. I'm going to separate them into conversational signals, conversational devices, and conversational rituals. Or we might say linguistic signals, devices, and rituals. I'm also going to introduce a concept that we'll be revisiting throughout the lectures, and that is complementary schismogenesis. And don't get too worried, that's the only kind of bulky term that I'm going to use. Complementary schismogenesis. This is a term that was developed by the anthropologist Gregory Bateson. He used it to describe what happens between cultures, broadly speaking, when they interact with each other, but I've adapted it to describe what can happen in conversation between two people, whereby small differences become big differences, and things often get worse instead of better when people have different conversational styles. So let's look at linguistic signals, devices, rituals, and complementary schismogenesis. What am I calling conversational signals? These are the building blocks of ways of speaking. So this is where we find amplitude, rate of speech, music of speech, attitudes toward overlap, and laughter. So for example, amplitude, how loudly or softly do you speak? And I'll just give you an example. There was a woman who grew up in New York and didn't even know she was hard of hearing until she moved to the Midwest, because people in New York City tend to speak more loudly than people in the Midwest. On the other hand, she later moved to Italy and found that she was having even less trouble hearing there because people in Italy tended to speak more loudly than people in New York City, and obviously much more loudly than people from the Midwest. There was a man who didn't even know when his coworker was angry because his voice would tend to get louder when he got angry, but his coworker's voice would get lower when he was angry. So we use these signals of how loudly or softly we speak to signal special meaning, but we also have a baseline that we use. If your baseline and the other person's baseline is different, then you can misinterpret their baseline as showing extra meaning, like anger. And if you've ever traveled to countries in the Mediterranean or Germany, you may know the impression that you think people are angry when they're just talking naturally. Let's look at rate of speech. How quickly or slowly do you speak? Now, we know that this varies by region, but also by age and by personal style. It's very common for young people, teenagers in particular, to speak more quickly. It's not unusual for parents to constantly say to their teenage children, slow down, slow down. One young woman who was in one of my classes, when I was telling her to slow down, she said, oh, yeah, my mother always says this. And she said, my mother goes, bitter. In other words, it was her mother imitating the impression that it made on the mother that the daughter spoke as quickly as she did. Now, we know from scientific research that it is actually easier for young people to process speech quickly than older people. The older we get, the more difficult it is to process speech. In fact, I had an article on the Washington Post not long ago about how a dialogue on television shows is actually speeding up. And this is quite deliberate, apparently, that producers, whereas they used to figure, okay, a page of script is going to take about a minute on screen, they now can go as quickly as 20 seconds per page. And they may even apparently use mechanical means to take out little tiny pauses so that it will go more quickly. Older people are constantly complaining that they have trouble following dialogue on television. I once asked my father what he thought of some of the political talk shows. He's a devotee of those shows. And he said, I don't know. I can't even follow what they're saying anymore. They talk so fast. Another of linguistic signals that I describe would be everything about the musical level of speech. Intonation, voice quality, the rhythms that are created when your intonation goes up or down. An anthropological linguist, John Gumpers, did a study of some employment labor issues where he was brought in as a consultant at the Heathrow Airport cafeteria. This was a cafeteria where the airport staff got served their meals. And there was a problem with recently hired Pakistani women who were working in the cafeteria. The British workers were complaining that the Pakistani waitresses were rude, and the Pakistani servers were complaining that they were being unfairly criticized. So he had people tape record what was going on in the interactions between the people serving food and the people getting served. And one thing he observed was if a person coming along the cafeteria line asked for meat, he had to be offered gravy. The British women would say, "Gravy?" The Pakistani women would say, "Gravy." They thought they were saying the same thing, but the meaning that came across was very different because of the intonation pattern. So the rising intonation, "gravy," was interpreted as, "Would you like gravy?" The falling intonation, "gravy," sounded like, "This is gravy." Well, simply saying, "This is gravy," had the meaning of sort of, "This is gravy, take it or leave it." So they were coming across as rude because they were using an intonation pattern that to them was simply polite, appropriate, the way you would say it, the way you would make an offer. I like this example, too, because it shows how if you understand these little linguistic signals and how they can make such a difference in the meaning that people get, you can have a way of understanding what's going on between people other than drawing conclusions about the individuals or a cultural stereotype. So the British people were thinking the Pakistani women were rude, and they were furthermore drawing a conclusion about all Pakistanis being rude. The Pakistani women were drawing conclusions that they were being unfairly treated, and furthermore, as Pakistanis, they were being discriminated against. So you can see how we go from this tiny little linguistic signal to all kinds of interactional, interpersonal forces that affect our lives. The next linguistic signal that I talk about is uses of and attitudes toward overlap. In other words, what do you think when two people talk at once? Do you assume conversation is always a matter where only one voice can be heard at a time? If a second person begins speaking, they're interrupting. That's a bad thing. Or do you sometimes talk along with somebody else, in other words, overlap, as a way to show that you're really listening and that you're really involved? And laughter is particularly interesting because there are many cultures, for example, Asian cultures, where laughter is an almost automatic signal that's used to smooth over uncomfortable moments, whereas in most Western cultures, people don't laugh to smooth over discomfort. They may. People may laugh uncomfortably, but it isn't as formalized as a cultural linguistic signal. We use these linguistic signals together to create linguistic devices. In other words, what do we do with these signals? So some of the things we do would be turn-taking, that is, negotiating the transfer of turns in a conversation, all the various forms of indirectness, questions, what can they be about, how do you ask them, complaining, insulting, teasing, irony, raising topics, how and when do we raise them, how do we pursue them, narrative, telling about our experiences, what can they be about, what's the point, all the various kinds of joking, telling jokes, but also just making jokes, being humorous, listenership, how you show that you're listening, all kinds of uses of ritualized opposition. So these are some of the linguistic devices that we create using the linguistic signals. I also talk about conversational rituals. Conversation has a ritual nature in that we have a sense not only of what this utterance means, but of what the next utterance is expected to be, how the whole exchange is expected to go. For example, in the United States, you meet someone, you might say, "How are you?" and you expect the answer, "Fine," or "Good," or "Not bad," or "Hanging in there." But you know that it's part of a conversational ritual by which you're exchanging greetings. It's not a literal question. You don't expect a literal answer, that is, a medical report. In Burma, when you meet someone, the question would be, "Where are you going?" And the answer is, "Over there." Or you might ask, "Have you eaten yet?" And the answer is, "Yes, I have." Literally, it's, "Have you eaten rice?" Well, if an American goes to Burma and gets the question, "Where are you going?" they might feel, "Gee, that's intrusive. What business is it of his where I'm going?" Or if someone says, "Have you eaten yet?" you might get the feeling that they're inviting you to lunch. So it's because of our understanding of the ritual nature of conversation that we can interpret these kinds of statements. Apologies would be a good example of a conversational ritual. For many people, if I say I'm sorry for X, I'm expecting you to say I'm sorry for Y. And if you don't do your part of the ritual, I might be kind of annoyed. For many people, complaining is a conversational ritual, whereas for other people, praising might be. And I have a personal anecdote to tell about this. Many, many years ago, my mother had visited me in Washington, D.C., where I live. And a friend of mine asked me how my mother's visit went. And I said, oh, it was a great visit, but, you know, she was got off the plane complaining, and I asked how was the flight, and she told me everything wrong with the flight. And my friend said, oh, my mother isn't like that at all. My mother never complains. In fact, if it's raining, she'll say, oh, it's raining today, but tomorrow the sun will be shining. Suddenly I thought, gee, why did I put my own mother down? My mother's wonderful. She's youthful. She's generous. She's loving. And then I realized that I had done exactly what I was saying my mother did. That is, I was using complaining as a ritual way of connecting to my friend. What my friend had done was exactly what she had said her mother did, which is she was putting a smiley face on everything. Because we didn't share that ritual, that a good thing to do about your mother is to complain, I realized the ritual nature of what I had done. Another example of a conversational ritual would be how you make a decision about where to go for dinner. So if you're with someone and you're trying to decide, would you start by saying, where would you like to go for dinner? Or would you start by making a suggestion? Let's go to Hamburger Hamlet. For some people, starting with a question would be a way to start a negotiation, and someone who makes a statement, names a restaurant, is making a demand. For other people, naming a restaurant is also a conversational ritual where you begin specific and then you're going to work your way out. So these are two different ways of doing the conversational ritual of deciding where to go for dinner. Whenever a ritual is not shared, it can be interpreted literally. So, for example, a person who is expecting a specific way of starting and gets asked, where would you like to go for dinner, might think they really are being asked to make the decision. And this is something that frequently happens between women and men, where women may ask a question because they just want to discuss it, and the man may think he's being asked to decide. Sometimes when rituals are not shared, the result can be positive. It isn't always negative. There was a study done by an Indonesian linguist named C.T. Suprapto. She studied an Indonesian gynecologist working in the United States and his interactions with his patients, his American patients, in a number of contexts. Indonesian is a culture where, as I mentioned earlier, laughter is used to smooth over uncomfortable topics. So because the Indonesian doctor was a gynecologist dealing with women, frequently things came up that were a little bit awkward, and so he would laugh. You might say this was a cultural misunderstanding because the American patients didn't know that this was an automatic conversational ritual that you would expect in Indonesia, but they liked it. It had a positive effect. And so in the clinic where he worked, women would often come in and say, I want that doctor who laughs a lot. It was something that they actually liked. So it can have positive consequences. So now we've looked at conversational signals, devices, and rituals. I want to say something about that bulky term that I introduced, complementary schismogenesis. This is a concept that was introduced by Gregory Bateson, as I mentioned. He is an anthropologist who, for a time, was married to Margaret Mead. I always like having to identify a man by telling you who his wife was. When there are differences in conversational signals and devices, sometimes the effect is that people get further apart rather than getting closer together. So, for example, if two people are speaking and one's idea of the level of loudness is a little bit louder than the other, if you feel the other person is speaking too softly, you might raise your voice to set a good example to get them to raise theirs. But if they already think that you're talking too loudly, they might lower their voice to give you a good example, to let you know you should talk more quietly. Well, that just frustrates the other person more, so they're going to get even louder. So you're going to get even softer. And so you can end up polarizing with one person whispering and the other one shouting. That's complementary schismogenesis. What each person is doing is driving the other into ever more exaggerated forms of the opposing behavior. My colleague Ron Scollin has talked about how when people have different senses of pacing and pausing, they can tend to polarize into a voluble one, someone who does all the talking, and a taciturn one, someone who doesn't talk at all. I'm going to read a dialogue now that actually took place between two friends that shows how complementary schismogenesis can work, where each person's behavior drove the other into more exaggerated forms of the opposing behavior. In this case, it was a kind of irony on the one hand and a kind of indirectness on the other. This conversation took place between two friends. Their names are John and Steve. Well, I'm calling them John and Steve. They were partners. They were preparing dinner together, and one was making the salad dressing. And John said, what kind of salad dressing should I make? And Steve said, oil and vinegar. What else? John, what do you mean, what else? Steve, well, I always make oil and vinegar, but if you want, we could try something else. John, does that mean you don't like it when I make other dressings? Steve, no, I like it. Go ahead, make something else. Not if you want oil and vinegar. I don't. Make a yogurt dressing. John prepared the yogurt dressing. He tasted it, and he made a face. So Steve said, isn't it good? John said, I don't know how to make yogurt dressing. Steve, well, if you don't like it, throw it out. John, never mind. Steve, what never mind? It's just a little yogurt. You're making a big deal about nothing. You are. A little thing can spark a big argument. But what you see happening here is that this little difference, that is Steve's use of irony, oil and vinegar, what else, set this off because John heard it as a demand for oil and vinegar. What he expected to be told was something like, make whatever you want. Now, the irony is that Steve said, make whatever you want, but he said it in this ironic way. And so everything he did to make it better made it worse. From John's point of view, he got more and more insistent, from oil and vinegar, what else, to make something else, to make yogurt dressing, to throw it out. So Steve was getting bossier by the minute. From Steve's point of view, John was just more and more intransigent in refusing to do whatever he wanted and to keep looking for Steve to tell him what to do. And it started with that little difference in the use of irony, oil and vinegar. I call it complementary schismogenesis because everything each said to respond to the other drove the other into more extreme manifestations of the opposing behavior. I want to look more closely now at a particular conversational device, and that is questions. Questions can do a whole range of things, but two of the things they can do would be to show interest or to be intrusive. So for some people, asking a lot of personal questions shows that you are interested in the other person, and it kind of proceeds on the assumption that people like to talk about themselves. But that assumption doesn't hold true for everybody. Some people don't like to talk about themselves, especially not with people they don't know that well. These differences can create great frustration in families. So one woman, for example, complained to her husband, "Your family isn't interested in me. They never ask me any questions." Other people might complain to a partner or to a friend, "Your family asks me so many questions. They're so intrusive." Here's an example of differing assumptions about the meaning of questions. This was told to me by a woman who heard me speak about this topic at a small meeting. And she said that it solved a puzzle that had been bothering her for more than 40 years. She was now a middle-aged woman. This happened when she was in college. She had had a blind date with a young man. She had tried her best to be a good person, show interest, be nice to him. When he dropped her off at the dorm, he said, "It was nice having dinner with the FBI. Well, this had always bothered her. Why in the world had he turned on her like that? What had she done to make him be so hostile? She realized after thinking about it this way and hearing me talk about it that she had been asking him a lot of questions in order to show interest, in order to get him talking. He had heard these questions as an interrogation. Here's another example. One woman was telling me about a most absurd blind date she had had, where she had had lunch with someone, and he had spent the entire time talking about himself, never asked her anything. And then at one point she said in frustration to him, "Why are you telling me all this?" And he said, "I'm trying to get to know you." Well, this struck her as so absurd that she told me about it. But I think that he was using the strategy that is the opposite of asking questions. So he was probably someone who thought it's rude to ask questions. And so the best way to get someone else talking is set a good example. You talk about yourself, and then they'll talk about themselves. The way we ask questions is also very important. So rate of speech, pitch, intonation, all these things will signal how the question is meant and will also influence the impression that you make as a person, which is, again, a kind of universal about conversational style. We think we're communicating meaning, but we're also communicating impressions of ourselves. I'm going to give you a little excerpt that actually took place in a conversation that I recorded and analyzed at length. It was a conversation that took place at Thanksgiving dinner quite a few years back. I was one of the people at the dinner. And as I've already said, I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I was talking to another person who was from Los Angeles. This is how the conversation went. I asked him, "You from LA?" He said, "Yeah." "You visiting here?" "Yeah." "What do you do there?" I work for Disney." "You a writer? Artist?" When I listened to this tape, I was mortified by the way I was peppering him with questions. In fact, I came to call it machine gun questions. How could I have done that? I realized, when I looked back at it and thought about it, that it was complementary schismogenesis. In other words, my way of asking questions was catching him off guard, and so it made him more hesitant. So it made me throw out more questions, and that made him more hesitant. We were driving each other to these more extreme versions of our different styles. The way that I asked the question, "You from LA?" is exactly what I think gave him the impression that I was kind of peppering him with machine gun fire. But for someone who shares this style, the high pitch and the clipped syntax is a way of signaling casualness. "I know this is an important question. I'm just trying to offer you the floor. Be generous. Give you a chance to talk. In fact, I knew that he was from Los Angeles, and I knew that he worked for Walt Disney. I was just giving him a chance to talk. But he didn't want a chance to talk." I'm actually still friendly with this person, amazingly enough. That was the first time I had met him. But he was actually a bit uncomfortable talking about himself, especially with somebody that he didn't know that well. And so the way I was signaling machine gun questions to show casualness and friendliness was not a conversational ritual he recognized. And so he didn't take it as casual. He took it as overwhelming. I had an insight into how the conversation might have gone in another conversation I was part of not very long after. Again, I was talking to someone that I didn't know very well. I had just met her. But this was one of those instances where everything goes great. You meet somebody for the first time, and wow, you're right on the same wavelength. One of the things that gave me that impression was her understanding of machine gun questions. In fact, she gave me a machine gun answer. So she was talking about her brother. And it was in the middle of a story about her brother, and you might say interrupt. I threw in the question, "What does your brother do?" And she said, "Lawyer," and then she went on. So by the high pitch, the fast pace, I was signaling, I'm not interrupting your story. This is just a by-the-way question to show that I'm interested in what you're saying, and I'm interested in your brother and your family. And she threw in the quick answer, "Lawyer," and went on, showing that she took it as I meant it, that she didn't feel interrupted. And it's that shared rhythm that I'm trying to point out here is so significant and goes so without notice when we talk to each other. So that was an example of a positive interaction from the shared rhythm and shared understanding of the machine gun question. Again, the theme that runs through this and through all the lectures that I'll be giving is that we don't think in terms of conversational style, we think in terms of personality, ability, and intentions. One of the other people who took part in that conversation that I analyzed at Thanksgiving dinner is a friend that I call David, and again, he's still a very good friend of mine. Around the same time, this was a time that I was living in California. It was when I was working on my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. I had a visit from my sister, who, like me, was born and raised in New York. And I had a little party, and my sister was talking to my various friends. And David came up to me all excited, and he said, "Your sister talks just like you." I told her I'd been to New York, and she asked, "Where?" Just like that. "Where?" Not, "Oh, really? Where did you go in New York?" Which is what I would have done. Just, "Where?" And he went on and he said, now, if I didn't know you and we hadn't talked about conversational style, I would have thought that your sister wasn't really interested in the fact that I had gone to New York and wasn't really interested in me. That where would have felt to me like she's rushing things along, trying to get this conversation over with. So there's several things about this anecdote that are of interest. It's not surprising that my sister had a style similar to mine because we both were raised in the same family and in the same part of the United States, same ethnic background. But also that David's inclination would have been to draw a conclusion about her attitude toward him and the kind of person that she is. Because he knew about conversational style, he was able to get past that and see her as a good person, which he, by the way, has since decided that she is. So David's impression of my sister as a person came from her use of the question where. The conversational device of the question, but the conversational signal of the way that she asked the question, the fact that it had falling intonation and the fact that it was clipped in syntax, where. For him, extra words would have carried the meaning of a question that he would have expected. Oh, really? Where did you go in New York? So the extra words would show a more leisurely pace that to him would show true interest. What's so significant here is we think of ourselves as showing interest or judging interest, but we're judging by these linguistic signals and how they're used in linguistic devices. The conclusions that we draw are about people, but we're basing those conclusions on these linguistic signals. So that's an example of a type of conversational style that can cause frustration, lead to false conclusions, but also cause frustration when people with different conversational styles talk to each other. When you talk to someone whose conversational style is relatively similar to yours, the conclusions that you draw are likely to be relatively accurate. When you talk to someone whose conversational style is relatively similar to yours, if you assume that they must mean what you would mean if you had said the same thing in the same way in the same context, chances are you're pretty likely to be accurate. If you talk to someone whose conversational style is relatively different from yours, then assuming that they mean what you would mean if you had spoken in that way in that situation may actually lead you to a wrong conclusion. That's why understanding conversational style is so important, because we don't all talk to people whose conversational styles are always the same as ours. So in this lecture, I've broken down the concept of conversational style a little more specifically into linguistic signals, linguistic devices, linguistic rituals, and I've introduced a concept that I'm going to be referring to in later lectures, and that is complementary schismogenesis. Why, when you talk to each other, sometimes small differences become big ones, and each person's use of the differing style drives the other into ever more increasing and exaggerated forms of the opposing behavior. In the next lecture, we'll look at another process that obtains in all conversations. It's another term that comes from the anthropologist Gregory Bateson, and that is framing and reframing.
After listening to Lecture 2, a student posed this question to Professor Tannen. Why do people subconsciously dislike the sound of their own voice? Let's listen to the professor's response.
I wouldn't use the word subconscious. I use the word automatic. Subconscious to me is something that when it's brought to your attention, you don't recognize it because it's in your subconscious. For example, Freud said you want to murder your father and marry your mother. And if I asked you, you'd say, what? Of course not. And Freud would say, I know it's true. It's just in your subconscious. These are not subconscious. If you ask me about it, if I listen to the tape, oh, yeah, I do that. But it's automatic. It's not something that I focus on when I'm doing it. And I think that is one of the reasons we don't like to hear ourselves on tape, because sometimes our way of talking, well, some of it, of course, is just we don't like the sound of our voices, but we hear ourselves doing things that we didn't really realize that we did, and the effect may not always be so positive. I think the reason it's automatic is, for us, it's just the way you talk. If you stop to ask yourself at every moment, what muscle will I use? It's almost like you tried to walk. You couldn't walk if you asked yourself, what muscle am I going to use? How am I going to put one foot in front of the other? You know, you just do it. And the same is true when we talk. We are thinking about what we want to say. And decisions about rate of speech, how loudly or softly, the particular words that we use. We just do what seems self-evidently the way to do it. And that's why talking about conversational style, learning about it, is such a revelation to people. People say to me, it's such a relief to understand the reaction that I'm getting may not be personal. It may have to do with the way that I spoke.
This ends Lecture 2. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399, and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.